Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, remember, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? My guest today is Pauline Brown. Pauline has over 30 years' experience acquiring, building, and leading some of the world's most influential luxury brands. She's perhaps best known for having served as chairman of North America for LVMH, the world's leading luxury goods company. But she's also taught a course at Harvard on the business of aesthetics. Currently hosts her own show on Sirius XM titled Tastemakers with Pauline Brown, and is out with her first book titled Aesthetic Intelligence, How to Boost It and Use It in Business and Beyond. This book was so much better than I ever imagined it would be. And I say that as someone who has always had an appreciation for aesthetics, but who has often conflated that with a distrust of fashion, of what I consider to be its inherent superficialities, fleeting distinctions, and labored rationalizations. I couldn't escape the sense that being fashionable meant caring about something that was utterly meaningless. Reading Pauline's book, I've come to view the business of aesthetics as more than just a superficial necessity of modern life. The way that Pauline writes about the allure she felt for the tubular and rich chocolate brown color of the Vidal Sassoon bottles of her early adolescence, or the affection she feels today for her classic, square-shaped, quilted, calfskin leather, blush-tone Lady Dior handbag with its gold tone accents, gave me an entirely new appreciation for the artistry, pleasure, and depth that can be found in the multisensorial encompassment that is the aesthetic experience, from which the business of fashion and beauty draws its inspirations and accentuates its enticements. If there is one message that I have taken away from Pauline's book and from our conversation today, it is this: aesthetics matter, and each of us has the potential to boost his or her own aesthetic intelligence through a process of attunement, interpretation, expression, and curation. To quote Pauline, when it comes to aesthetics, editorial command is all important. As Coco Chanel said, elegance is refusal. And with those words, I bring you my conversation with Pauline Brown. Pauline Brown, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you for having me.
It is wonderful having you in studio. I was telling you how much I enjoyed your book.
I appreciate the fact that you read it, and you clearly, from your notes, read it cover to cover, so I'm especially appreciative.
We're famous for our notes here. You know, so as you can see, I have 12 pages of a rundown here of material to go off of, but before we kind of go down that path, maybe you can tell our listeners, again, I read the book, but what is the book about? The book is called Aesthetic Intelligence. What is this about?
So I had a few agendas in writing it. First of all, I had spent close to 3 decades in industries that wouldn't exist without very high aesthetic content. Fashion, cosmetics, luxury goods. There's no reason to buy any of them for utility, right? So it was clear to me in those industries, and they're big industries, really big, multi-billion dollars in each case, in every subsector within. But it was clear to me that there was something going on in the industry that was, assumed to be required there. And yet there are all these other industries that, with rare exception, never thought that aesthetics matter for them. And then every couple decades, some entrepreneur or industry leader would come around and really transform that industry by bringing in some what I call aesthetic content. And I think the most prominent example would be Steve Jobs, who for the first time in history said, computers are not just there for processing power. They're not just there for speed and efficiency, but they actually are part of a consumer and a user's identity. And why can't it look good wherever it's sitting in a room? And in fact, he had this famous line that the back of my Apple computers looks better than the front of, I think it was HP's.
Could have said I didn't know that line.
Or about Dell, any of them.
Great.
He could have used
what
any of the competitors. And then, you know, I take that forward to more recently, like a Dyson. You know, who would have thunk that vacuum cleaners are anything other than dust accumulators and dust collectors? And the goal in Dyson's design was something that actually didn't have to be stowed away in a closet. And now he's taken that particular design principle and engineering prowess and into other categories, you know, like air purifiers and hair dryers and so forth. So I started to see that some of the capabilities that, you know, always existed in fashion and luxury goods were making their way into other industries, but very slowly. And I combine that with the fact that we live in an age where the traditional factors for success, which were built on efficiencies and scale and global expansion, that no longer works. That's just a race to the bottom. And we've sort of taken all of that as pretty much as far as we humans can. And so I called this aesthetic competency, it actually started as a class at Harvard called The Business of Aesthetics, which then led to the book. And I decided it wasn't enough to talk about the business of aesthetics, which is how aesthetics create value, but how do people bring aesthetics into companies? And that is what I call aesthetic intelligence. Mm. And that is what the book is about.
Your class sounds amazing. The students, it's not the first time I've heard you talk about it. The student body must also be very interesting.
I was surprised. So when I was first given this platform to teach at Harvard, I assumed that my students would comprise mostly of aspiring marketers, maybe brand managers, people who wanted to go into consumer industries. And there were a good number of those types. But in every section I taught, I had at least one medical doctor because I allowed a certain number of cross matriculants. I had some people who had either come from or were going back to work for Google. I had hedge fund investors. And what that said to me is that there was something in the idea, whether or not I execute is another story, but there was something in the idea of the business of aesthetics that hit a button or hit a chord with all these different people in businesses that, you know, wouldn't have been obvious that they needed this or that it would benefit them.
Fascinating. I got that feeling also that the interdisciplinary application of what you talk about in the book, I got that sense. Do you feel that working now at Harvard, being in the role of a professor effectively, and also having your own radio program, that gives you an opportunity to maybe reflect on the work that you've done after so many decades in the business and to begin to assimilate some of that and process it in a way that you wouldn't otherwise?
Well, yes and no. So first of all, I stopped teaching after 2 years at Harvard, in part because teaching is a very time-intensive activity. And what it allowed me, which is to your point, is it gave me the independence of thought that I never had as a corporate person. As a corporate person, I really was very captive to what my business card said and what the talking points of the company or the brand were. As a professor, you know, I had, I would say, you know, two guiding principles as to what I would teach and talk about. And one is what I thought the truth was. And the second is what my opinion on that, you know, said. And so I had a level of freedom that I hadn't known in any of my business jobs. The reason I say yes and no, and this was a frustration of mine in the classroom, but I put a lot of effort into basically illuminating or aspiring to illuminate or to educate as many as 100 students. And that was a very full section. And I felt like, how can I take what I think is a big idea, what I hope is a big idea, and reach a lot more people? Mm. And for that, the book really became my vehicle.
Mm. So when did you start the radio program?
Oh, radio program happened in parallel and with absolute no connection to the course. So as I was saying a moment ago, for the first time in my career, I didn't have to ask anyone for permission other than maybe my then 13-year-old daughter. I didn't have a boss. So when SiriusXM had come to me initially because they wanted more sort of more creative angle on their business station, I asked my real boss, which was me, you know, would I like to do this? Do I have enough to say? Would it be fun? And the answer to all three questions was yes. And so that happened about 3 years ago. After about a year of doing a show on the business channel, which was called Trendsetters, my show was called Trendsetters, I decided I liked everything about the experience except talking about business. I was actually very interested to talk to creative people about creative process, about ideas, about lifestyle. And so lo and behold, they moved me to the Starz Entertainment Channel and we rebranded it Tastemakers. And I've been on for about 2.5 years now.
So I heard a podcast by Tastemakers that you hosted a panel of three women. One of them was a very funny Russian esthetician.
Oh, yeah, the skincare. Yeah.
What a funny woman.
Oh, she's a good friend. Karina Friedman.
She was so funny.
She is so funny.
I know many, many women like that. I feel like you're going to blow up with this book.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we're recording this before the book has come out, so we don't know yet, but that's my feeling. So I want to say one more comment on one more thing, and then maybe we can kind of go to the beginning of the book and start to drill into some of the things you discuss. You mentioned Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs has, of course, that great story of how he audited the calligraphy course at Stanford. And if he hadn't audited that course, he wouldn't have learned about Sanskrit and the Mac would not have had the beautiful typography, he said.
I think that's a myth, but okay. I know he said it.
Oh, it's not true?
I think it's true that he audited the course, and I think it's true that it had an impression on him. I think he's made much of a very marginal experience.
That's interesting. Well, he did do that. In fact, he did that a lot. So, but the place that I wanted to end up was actually attention to detail. I got that sense throughout the book, and I get that sense generally speaking when I speak with people that are incredibly successful at something that they do better than anyone else, is a maniacal focus with detail and with, if not perfection, then certainly the perfect application of oneself. And, you know, even with theater, if you go to theater, every night is different. There's no perfect play or version, but you can bring your all to that performance. And I think bringing all of yourself to something. And so that sort of stuck out to me in the book. And I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to go through it again. But I want to sort of go to the beginning. You talked about this pivotal moment for you when you were a kid in 1976. You write, I yearned for only three things in life, pierced ears, a puppy, and a Panasonic take end tape. I begged my parents for all of them, though getting any one of them would have made me deliriously happy. And then you go on and you actually, it's actually much longer. Apparently you didn't get the puppy or the piercings until later, but you did get the take end tape. I wasn't familiar with the take end tape, but there was a whole family of these portables. Panasonic portables, and the tagline for Panasonic in the 70s was just slightly ahead of our time.
And you look at it now with those stubby buttons and those electric colors.
Even now, looking at this, right, it really is beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. And you know what? I had a similar sort of light bulb moment probably 5 years later, six, 7 years later, with my first Sony Walkman and that taxi cab yellow covering. And just the elegance and how it sat in the hand and the idea. I mean, but obviously the technology is exciting because in that case, I could, you know, listen to music without bothering other people on the go. But I think in both cases, you know, as much of my own joy came from just the silhouettes of these products and the colors and the way they, you know, interacted tactily and so forth. Yeah, beautifully designed devices in both
cases. Indeed, yes. I mean, the Sony Walkman was so were you... You come across in the book as being unusually aware of your aesthetic environment. And reading the book, I forced myself, so to speak. I was consciously trying to do that last week and kind of look at different people. And I suddenly did become aware of all the diversity of how people express themselves in the physical world through fashion and through other means. Were you always that way?
Well, so the short answer is I think I was slightly more aware in general than others. I don't think significantly more aware. I think we are all aware of a lot of things. We don't articulate what we see, and we don't necessarily look for pattern recognition or try to understand how to get ahead of it, or even ask ourselves, why do I have such affinity now with a Balenciaga sneaker or whatever the thing of the moment would be? I think I probably asked myself, and it probably goes back to my sort of German heritage and culture, you know, the question, the four questions, why do I like this so much? But people always ask me, can you actually teach aesthetic intelligence, which is another word for taste? Can you actually teach taste? And I say, absolutely. I mean, you don't teach a child to enjoy ice cream. There are just certain things we enjoy, certain things we enjoy a lot, and certain things we really don't like as humans. You know, in the history of humans, I don't think anyone has ever said, you know, I'd like to listen to another round of that jackhammer. I mean, it just doesn't sound good to the human brain, which doesn't mean that there's one taste in sound. There are people who love classical music. There are people who love folk music. There are similarly in taste. There are people who have sweet tooth. There are people who love salty, crunchy things. But the fact that we love sensations is a human thing. Mm. What we do with it and how we continue to fight the elements, because the world is constantly trying to numb our senses. It's trying to tell us to eat foods because they're good for you, not because they taste good. It's trying to tell us to, you know, withstand certain conditions in a workspace, whether it's fluorescent lightings, because that's what we've been conditioned to think is a good or standardly designed office space. It is corrosive.
You know, that reminds me of a line from a book by Norman Mailer that I read years ago. It was a nonfiction book. I can't remember the name of it, but he was describing how air travel had become dreadful. Mm-hmm. And he talked about it as part of this larger move towards plastics.
Oh, interesting.
And he talked about the overhead bin and everything else and how things used to be made out of wood or metal. So there's this thing that comes across again in the book, and perhaps I misspoke when I talked about people's fashion or exterior appearance, because actually there's a sense, I mean, you talk about the multisensorial experience in the book. There's a sense in which part of what we're talking about here is awakening one's senses, right? Mm-hmm. So how much of that is about awakening? And also how much of it is about authenticity, about authentically being in touch with what you find pleasurable?
So first of all, I just have to comment on the Norman Mailer quote. I always say that the two most aesthetically disturbing experiences in modern society are going through airports and hospitals. Because in both cases, they are there to process people who are dealing with health issues or administrative issues, or in the case of airports, obviously travel and mobility. They're in both cases so incredibly dehumanizing. And someone could say critically, well, you know, isn't the most important thing when it comes to an airport that there's security checks? Or isn't the most important thing when you're being, you know, wheeled into a hospital that you're being properly cared for, you know, whatever the reason you're there for? Of course. But as we've seen in all other industries, you know, somebody is going to make a decision of what color to paint the wall. It isn't like there's no paint on the wall, and it isn't like there isn't any tile on the floor. So maybe if that somebody who was responsible for that decision took another 3 seconds and gave a thought to how does it actually make people feel to stand on that floor or to look, you know, for hours in a day against that wall. You know, there's a lot of choices. This is not about investment. It's really about mindfulness. So to go back to your question about, is this about awakening? I always say that in the process of developing your aesthetic intelligence, there are four distinct steps. And the very first step, and it's so fundamental, is exactly that. It's awakening, or what I called in the book, attunement. You won't be able to do anything in terms of starting to curate your own space if you don't have a strong sense of what space you're in right now. And I always say that there's the visible elements or the palpable elements of a space. And then there are other elements that I refer to as invisible design. So for example, when you think of your favorite restaurant, and if I asked you, well, what do you like about the restaurant? You know, 9 out of 10 people would say, well, I love the food. Of course you love the food. You know, you're not going to love the restaurant if you don't love the food in most cases. And then I'd say, well, what else do you like? Because you could have picked any restaurant. And you might say, well, I really like the design of the space. Okay. And maybe the design would be the selection of chairs and paneling and so forth. But very few people will say things like, you know what, the lighting, it makes me and my partner look so good. Or the acoustics is such that I can hear the music, but I can also hear the conversation. That's invisible design. It has an enormous impact on how you feel about the experience, but we don't identify it in the time. And if you're attuned, you start to identify those cues. So that is the first step, attunement. Of course, it doesn't stop with attunement, because you can't, when you think of the people who are the most tasteful that we all know, it's not just because they're aware. It's because they take that awareness and they interpret it and they edit it and they express it in ways that get very exciting and original and authentic.
So a few points about hospitals. I completely agree. In fact, I would take it much further, because I think in hospitals, the health impact of the anxiety, of the isolation, of the antiseptic, sterile environment, I think is, you said, dehumanizing. And it's a place where I think we need to feel as human as possible.
Yes.
Because we're in some cases confronting very serious mortal issues. Richard Branson, an interesting example of someone who transformed air travel with Virgin, right? And I think also in a way that's was interesting about Branson to me is that was he, maybe he wasn't, the first to deploy in-flight Wi-Fi?
He may have been, actually. I know he was early and I know he was loud about it. I know he also was early and loud about massages on the flights. I don't know how well that stuck, though. But it was a good idea.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We actually also did, side note for our listeners, we did this great episode with Safi Bakal. It was on phase transitions, but we covered Pan Am, the jet age, and Jet Set, and the transformation that happened during the deregulation. But it's an interesting point to note just because it was so glamorous and it was such a different experience back then flying versus what it is today.
And by the way, if you want to relive any of that, I highly recommend going to the TWA bar and hotel at JFK.
Are you really
familiar with this?
No, when did they open
that
up?
So the original, it opened up earlier this summer. They took the terminal that was a landmark building, extraordinary work of design that had been defunct for decades, but had been just sitting there, and they reopened it as a hotel right at JFK. Everything is very retro, very kitschy.
Wow.
It's really well done, and it's a lot of fun.
That's very cool. So when my point about Richard Branson and the Wi-Fi was, I believe Branson had said that it's not just about how long the flight is. It's about how you perceive the flight and also what can you do when you're on the flight. So if you have a lot of work to do, but you have access to Wi-Fi and the flight takes, let's say, an extra hour, let's say it takes 6 hours instead of 5 hours versus a flight where you're on 5 hours, but you have no Wi-Fi, maybe you'd prefer to be on a 6 hour flight with Wi-Fi. I thought that was interesting, just sort of the interdimensionality of that. Another point that came up when you were talking had to do with design, about the invisible design. I read a book years ago called The Design of Everyday Things. And one of the things that I remember from the book, among many, was door handles and how many times that there might be a handle on a door that you're only supposed to push, right? Anyway, that came into my mind. So you have, to bring it back to the book, you have this other great scene. I mean, you were in Dartmouth in your 20s. We mentioned that. There's another great line in the book where you talk about having been in your head in your early 20s and that you had lost your way stylistically. Talk to me a little bit about that. How did that transformation happen from when you left college, where you were in this Northeast college town, where you talked about eschewing the defeminized look of your female classmates with their duck boots?
And I have a picture. It doesn't get more unisex than that.
I have a picture here of a girl wearing this kind of, you know, green color. You mentioned it was a very much like the
Timberlands.
Exactly. So how did you go from that to getting into the fashion industry? Because you've worked in so many places, I wasn't really able to follow that transition.
Okay. Well, let me start by saying there were two things that happened in my life over the course of, let's call it a 10-year period, that led to what I describe as sort of a numbing of my aesthetic senses. One of those two trend lines, very, very common. So one is that I was a serious student, and like all people who immerse themselves in their studies, you're really praised and reinforced and encouraged to develop your intellectual capacity. You don't get a whole lot of credit for showcasing other capacities in a classroom setting. And I think it is, by the way, one of a few problems with standard American education. You know, American education relative to other countries is seen as fostering creative thinking, but I would say for the most part, it is still very geared toward test taking. And as somebody who's competitive and someone who took my schoolwork very seriously, I just feel like I spent so many hours sitting in my head. And to be aesthetic is not to be an artist, right? So oftentimes people
How can you explain?
So to be an artist is to be a maker, whether you're making a painting, you're creating something. Steve Jobs was not an artist. He, you know, may have said he took this calligraphy class, as we talked about, but he never produced anything. Not with, he did nothing with his hands. What he did was have an imagination of what good looked and felt like to
him.
He
would say he had taste, he would say.
He had taste. You know, and I would say there's probably a more powerful word. Maybe the expression is aesthetic intelligence. But it wasn't just that he had taste, because it was his taste. And by the way, his taste is not my taste. It is not Victorian taste. But it was so clear and so crisp and so well executed. And what he had was an ability to mobilize thousands of people, some of whom were artists or working in his art departments and creative units, to execute on his vision. So first things first, there's a difference between being a creative or a maker or an artist or an artisan and being someone with high aesthetic intelligence. So as somebody who clearly wasn't going to go down an art path, I didn't have really an opportunity or mentorship or encouragement to explore this other side. If I were, it would just be because I was doing it because I wanted my bedroom to look pretty or I wanted to look adequately well, you know, in an outfit. But again, there was no sort of training of that portion of my brain. Point number one. Point number two, which may be more particular to my story than others, is I also went through such radically different style shifts or environments that shape style. So people ask me at times, so where do you think people's individual tastes come from, since I referenced that there's a lot of different types of taste. There's bad taste, but within the range
of... We may have another great quote in the book where you actually say there certainly are, something like along those lines. I don't have it on the rundown, but...
Right. I mean, there is bad taste, right? And sometimes I even find it, you know, and bad taste can be kind of amusing and enjoyable too, but let's come back to that. But within the range of what we would call good taste, there are so many different styles. And I've asked myself, so why is this particular set of influences what shape this person's taste and another very different shape another person's taste? And I sort of say some of it's a factor of the age in which you live. If I was born in the 1800s, same person, I'd have a very different outlook. Some of it is geography. So as a New Yorker versus someone living in Tokyo, I have a very different set of influences. Some of it is personal and family and my own family history, which I talk about in the book and how that shaped what felt good and right to me. So to get back to this idea, I had over the course of a 10-year period or so, very different influences that conflicted each other. So I was a first-generation American, came from a very European home, a lot of sort of Victorian-era goods and knickknacks and sort of historical relics, then moved to Long Island. I was in a very materialistic world, very fashion-forward, very loud, fashion-wise and otherwise. And then I'm up in this sort of the ultimate preppy enclave up at Dartmouth. And it was a very different set of what felt good to the norm of those populations. And I don't think I was strong enough to go through that sort of series of different experiences to know what feels good to me. And so I come out of that, and it took a period of time, and it doesn't happen quickly, to sort of get back into my body and my senses.
So you're saying in some sense you were exposed to a variety of aesthetic environments?
I think the combination that I wasn't attuned, so I was in my head, and the influences around me that I otherwise would have probably mimicked, which is what people do who don't, you know, necessarily have a strong internal compass, were all conflicting. You know, what felt good to the community up in New England was markedly different than what felt good to sort of my more ethnic, progressive New York area friends and family.
So did you not, because there's a point in the book where you talk about transitioning from Bain and Company, the private equity firm, to the Estee Lauder companies. So did you begin in finance? And was that the transition that you made into...
Right. Again. Well, a well-kept secret, which I'll share with you, so I guess it won't be a secret anymore, is, so I've always enjoyed color. And one thing that I used to do, it was just a personal passion as a young teen, is I would read, you know, the girls in the fashion magazines, the 17 and teen, and probably if I really wanted to be aspirational, I'd look at Vogue. And I would study particularly, because I wasn't really into fashion, but I'd really study the makeup. And how the market makeup artist and how what products they were using and what colors they were using and how they were, in my mind, transforming or potentially transforming faces. And I used to practice on my sister and on my girlfriends. And I was sort of this closet makeup artist, not trained, but it never left me to the point where I actually have done entire wedding parties gratis because I really enjoy doing people's makeup.
What do you enjoy about that?
I enjoy the transformation. I enjoy the mixing of colors. I enjoy... even just the sensorial application of the brushes and the ointments and everything about it, I enjoy. I enjoy the intimacy of just sitting very closely and seeing a face in proximity that we normally don't. Hmm. But most of all, I enjoy the transformation. So reason I'm bringing this up is I didn't know when I was leaving Bain what I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to be, and I was on the strategy consulting side of the business. I knew I wanted to get into a product company. I knew that I had, you know, I just felt more connected to product than I did to service. It was a sort of instinctive response. And I knew that certain types of products spoke to me. So my thinking wasn't much more sophisticated than that. And so among the products that spoke to me, and I remember looking at music and entertainment, was makeup. And so I got from Bain to Estee Lauder in part because I had a good strategy background and they wanted a strategy person. But underlying all that was actually an excitement to be in the sector, even though I knew nothing about makeup other than how to put it on a face.
So you have this great scene. There are a number of these, like, you know, moments or scenes or quotes in the book that stuck out to me. I like to collect quotes. And the, I guess the CEO at the time was Langhammer?
Fred Langhammer, yes.
Fred Langhammer.
Very tough German man.
Tough German man. So you have a scene where you talk about walking into his office. This was on your first day?
Probably my first week or two.
And you put together a deck. What was this? This deck was just...
I mean, at Bain...
We've all had to deal with these decks. They're exhausting.
Oh, exhausting. And I thought that was one does, because that's what one does at Bain.
So you described the deck. This is what stuck out to me the most. I liked it. You described it as... It clinically described historic performance, but offered no big ideas or forward-looking solutions.
Yeah, lots of graphs.
Yeah, but clinically described. I thought that really stuck out to me.
Well, the irony is that one of the biggest brands within Estee Lauder at the time was Clinique, which sounds just a little bit more romantic than clinic.
So, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, we all look for moments or we remember things as this was a turning point or things are a little bit more messy than that. But certainly there seems to have been sort of, in some sense, an unlearning on your part.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, so I remember in that particular incident, Fred, who was a no-nonsense guy, and he just threw down the deck. You know, this is not someone who... As a CEO and frankly, as a German, he did not want me wasting his time. And he looked at this and he knew it was a waste of time. And I was shocked because, again, my training was such that this is how you look at business. Mm. You look at it dispassionately. And I think it was one of the first times, you know, and it took me many, many years to piece this all together, that I realized that this is not impersonal, that I have to bring as much of myself to this job as possible. And by the way, I had an advantage that Fred Langhammer, my boss and CEO, did not have. I wear the stuff. Like, he could only imagine how a mascara feels on lashes. As far as I know, he didn't wear mascara. But I was treating myself as if I were just an observer, as he and all the other executives were. And so I think over time, I learned that the more I could integrate how I feel about things as a consumer, as a woman, as an American, and then what I think about them as well, that the more powerful I could be in my role. And it certainly played out that way.
So this, yeah, this part really resonated with me. And it also dovetails well with a lot of what I've tried to do with Hidden Forces, particularly in the early stages when we first launched the podcast. We did an episode, for example, on phenomenology with Christian Mespia, episode 14 for listeners. Christian does some type of design work, generally speaking. I know he did some design work with Chrysler when they launched the Continental, but it had to do with the fact that, and I have a background working in fields where there's a lot of quantitative analysis. And a phenomenon that often occurs is that people mistake the map for the territory, right? And it felt very much like that was something you were describing there. And I wonder, how common is that in your industry and generally speaking in what you see, that people become so fixated on the process or on the model that they've used to simplify the real world, and they don't engage with the world as it is. How common is that?
I think it's ubiquitous. And I think the bigger companies are and the more established companies are, the more common it is, which is a real disadvantage, by the way. It's why entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial setups are moving so much more quickly and gaining so much share, is that they're real, they're authentic, they're connected to what's happening in the marketplace. I think big companies are totally disconnected. And the people who work for these big companies, if they are connected when they start, they very quickly become out of touch. I think it's a real problem.
So how on earth do you, because I don't think I could ever be successful at a large company. There's very little media of you out there. on YouTube, but there's this one video where it's about like 4 minutes or so, 5 minutes, and you talk about an experience at, maybe it was when you were at Bain, but you were working with a company that was going under restructuring, and they had to let go of people, and everyone was fighting for headcount, and you realized that you didn't really, even though headcount was a power base, that you didn't really want that because you wanted to be able to focus, you wanted to be free of that, so you could focus on innovating or kind of moving the company forward. What do you think the biggest challenges are for being successful at your level? Because again, you know, one of the positions that you held was that you were chairman of North America for LVMH.
Yeah. Well, so a couple of things. I mean, first of all, I think it's really important for a person, wherever they sit in an organization, to be brutally self-honest. And by that, I don't mean self-critical, but I mean honest about what you genuinely like and how you thrive and where you get energy and what saps you of energy. So many people I know start to answer those questions with regards to what's in the best interest of their institution or where they think they'll be best rewarded instead of who they genuinely are. You know, and it's not come overnight, but over the years, I've become very clear with what's important to me, with what I'm willing to trade off in order to have the things where I thrive and to put myself in settings where I can do well. So if you take the LVMH example, and there were aspects of that experience in which I thrived enormously, and there were aspects of it I found crippling. But one of the things, it's a very big company. But if you peel the onion, and I don't like big companies, by the way.
Which I found fascinating because you mentioned that, and I found that perplexing.
But the reason I'm you know, the devil's in the details. If you peel the onion on LVMH, it really is a collection of a lot of small companies with a few big ones thrown in. So 70 brands, you have a couple that are $10 billion a year, very small number, you know, could count them on one hand.
Do they own Gucci?
No, that's their arch competitor. They own Vuitton is one of the mothership brands, and Hennessy and Christian Dior, and Marc Jacobs, and you know, I could name about 65 others. But they have a few really big brands. The vast majority of the brands within that portfolio are really small, surprisingly small. They're old, they're well-known, established, but they're small. And so I always looked at that company as more of a collective than I did of a big corporation. And for that reason, it worked for me.
So actually, let's make a little slight detour, stay where we are a little bit, because I pulled out some of these things from that video. This wasn't actually in your book, though you touched on it. We touched on the first one. You had these four turning points. One was, we touched on it with Fred, think and act like an owner, not like an agent. And I think that's what you were alluding to about the entrepreneur.
So the dispassionate analysis that I initially approached Lauder with, which did not work. I mean, you know, people who are successful are generally not thinking first and foremost, what's it going to take for me to succeed in this job? They're thinking first and foremost, what's it going to take for me to create value? And that's an owner's mentality.
And also, I think that the sense of being in touch with the consumer. I mean, you mentioned that, that as a woman, that you had actually tried these products.
I love, and it's probably because I'm a freak of nature, I love going to stores, not even to shop. Just for me, it's an anthropological experience. It is like, I get more joy than kids do going to zoos. And I like to see how people navigate when they walk in shops. I like to see even merchandise that I would never remotely buy, like what's sitting there and why, and what's moving and what's not. I'm fascinated by how stores get designed and how misdesigned most of them are. So, you know, for all sorts of reasons, you know, and it was a real frustration for me at another stage in my career when I was a private equity investor focused on consumer and retail, that my colleagues spent 90% of their time in their offices looking at spreadsheets and financial projections and modeling and otherwise. And I felt like, you know, the rubber meets the road in the store. And people like Leonard Lauder, who's the former chairman of Estee Lauder, or Bernard Arnault, who's the current chairman of LVMH, they spend more time in the stores than most of their people.
So I'm going to touch on something. We're jumping around a little bit here because I've got it all over the place. But I have this in a different section talking about the halo effect, which I find fascinating. And I want to ask you about that. But this is so directly tied to what you just said. There's a quote from the book where you write, "If you go to a Lauder beauty counter and inquire about a particular moisturizer, the salespeople will rub it into your hand as if they are giving you a massage. In doing so, they create a very intimate, warm moment that for most people is enjoyable and relaxing. How can you not buy the product?
It sounds so sinister.
No, but I mean, to your point, and that's about being in the store. And then I'll throw another one out there because you mentioned the department stores, and I do want to get into that as well. You write, it's not that traditional retail stores are dying. It's that they've lost their way. They're formulaic. And what's worse, forgettable.
Oh, yeah. Forgettable is the worst.
Forgettable. What's worse than forgettable? Nothing. But there's that word there's that word again, though. Formulaic. Mm-hmm. Clinical. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Those things, and I can't give you an exact reason, and maybe you can answer, but what are you driving at when you use words like formulaic and clinical?
Right. Well, the irony of ironies, in both cases, those two words are typically associated with scientific experiments and with big data and analysis.
Dehumanizing environments.
And, you know, we've lived in a world where STEM is everything. Science, technology, engineering. Mm-hmm. And I say, great, by no means am I suggesting we throw data out the window. We have more data than we know what to do with, and we should be making better use of it. But I'm saying it's just not enough. Mm. Most industries are not going to win on data alone. And that's why I call aesthetic intelligence, which I think is one of the few areas we still can win as humans, the other AI.
Yeah, I mean, I was about to go there, obviously, the play on words. Let's go back again to a little bit. You made a point earlier about, I don't know if you articulated it this way, but you've articulated this way in the past, fight for what drives you, not for what drives others. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the significance of that? Taking it back a little bit to the context of your management style and how to be successful working at the top of a major corporation.
Yeah. Well, a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, first of all, I think that philosophy is not only an easier way to live, but I think it's a more enjoyable way. I mean, for so many people I know, they kind of bifurcate their life. This is who I am in my office. Mm. This is how I express myself. This is how I decorate my space or have someone else decorate my space. This is my wardrobe for my professional being. And then they have their personal space. And there's so little connectivity between that. And especially for working moms, which I am, it's exhausting. Mm. So I, just to use it, my closet as a metaphor, like long ago, I stopped saying, this is where my work clothes are and this is where my play clothes are. Hmm. You know, now there are certain things that would be, you know, out of range. I'm not going to wear a sweatsuit to a board meeting. But for the most part, you know, I bring it all together. I want to be comfortable when I'm at a meeting. And I also want to express myself and look presentable, you know, when I'm going to yoga. Mm. And how I integrate, it's really about a sort of more of a fluidity in our life, which makes it easier to live, but I think more enjoyable.
That's interesting. I thought of it in a different way. You know, I think one of the common characteristics that successful people have is that I think they tend to have a chip on their shoulder. Mm. There's something that doesn't sit right with them.
I have lots of chips.
Yeah. So I think it is a common, at least in my personal experience and the experience of people I know, that we fight battles whose origins go back to our childhood, or in some cases go back so far we can't remember where they came from. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge to extract yourself or your own volitions or desires from those that are shadows, really. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. How do you know when you're fighting for what drives you and not what drives others?
Well, I would go back to the question you asked at the beginning of the interview, which is, what's the first step in developing aesthetic intelligence? It's this very basic concept of attunement. Mm. I think the more attuned, and now in that case, it's attunement to how things feel that are hitting you sensorially. Mm. In the case of professional and leadership conduct, it's about how do things feel based on how you're behaving or how others are reacting and how that sits with you. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a non-confrontational person, but I get no joy in fighting. I know people who enjoy a good fight.
You seem like you could be good at it, though.
Well, I defend my ground.
You don't seem like a pushover.
No, I'm not a pushover, but I'm a lioness. You know, I defend my cubs, but I'm not an aggressor, right? And so I fight for things, you know, that to me are, whether it's survival or it's my territory, I'll certainly fight. But I am not going to fight for battles that I just don't care to win. Hmm. That's not my nature.
And my point, though, that I was trying to get at is, at least in my own personal life and experience, it's been a challenge and it's taken a lot of work and reflection and maturation to extricate myself from other people's battles or battles that I've been fighting for so long that I thought they were mine, but they're really not. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And look, this, we're all growing, you know, and I feel like I'm still growing and learning and experimenting and getting it wrong and course correcting. And that's part of the journey. And I do think, though, people who are successful over time, I mean, there's a lot of people who have moments of success. Sustainable success takes a different character. But people who are successful over time are good learners.
So there are a lot of other things from the book that I do want to get into, but I'm curious to talk to you a little bit about, I keep writing it down as fashion. I know this isn't exactly right because the book's not about fashion.
But you know, but fashion is an important symbol.
Yeah. So, I mean, and the truth is, in case it isn't already obvious to you and to everyone listening, I don't know much about the industry. In fact, reading the book, I bought this book years ago called Elegance in the Age of Crisis. And that was driven by my own interest in things like the lipstick indicator and the hemline indicator from my background in finance and economics and markets. And the book was about how fashion changed during the Depression. And I've always found stuff like that very fascinating and interesting. We did an episode, episode 4, 2 years ago when we started the program, which was on the history of American television and culture as historian and culture maker, how television interacted with the people and people interacted with the tele, and that created society. But I'm fascinated by fashion. I'm fascinated by how it works. I'm fascinated by what constitutes innovation in fashion. So maybe you can educate me and our listeners. Where do you think the world of fashion is today? Where are we today?
Oh, it's so broken. You know, I think when I was coming of age, it really was setting sort of a mood that would extend all the way through the market. There were certain industries, generally ones like automotive that have long timelines, that were probably earlier in areas like color selection or textile trends. But fashion was able to absorb all of these early trends, bring it together in a spirit, and kind of establish the structure of a market and a big market. Things have changed markedly. I mean, first of all, very few shoppers look to the runway to indicate what they're going to be wearing, whether it's now or in a year from now.
They used to do that?
They used to do that.
Really?
So, well, if not shoppers, there'd be buyers,
tastemakers.
And that what I would have seen coming out of Paris Fashion Week, which was just a week ago, and determining the collections for spring of 2020 or fall of 2020, there would be this cascading effect. And it would start with fashion, but then it would ripple through beauty or through sort of other related image-oriented businesses. It just doesn't work that way anymore. Part of the reason is I think the best and brightest creative minds are not going into fashion, at least not in America. They're going to Hollywood, so entertainment is hugely impactful. They're going to Silicon Valley, so technology has become a creative hotbed, albeit a different kind of creativity. You know, so there are structural changes in the industry. I think the economics of fashion have also made it very unwelcoming of that next generation, and have not had the fuel to really invest in innovation the way, for example, Silicon Valley has. So I don't look at fashion today as where I'm going to determine where the real people are going. It's
That's
almost
interesting.
It's almost
where the creative people are going, or the
where
aesthetically
the
masses, intelligent
where
people.
The what I'm going to see, you know, so for the same reason, I don't look at New York, where I live, or other major cities like LA, as necessarily spawning the next great creative thinkers. I go to these sort of second tier cities like Nashville or Savannah, Georgia. And I was like, wow, really? And why? Because the big cities like New York have become so expensive to operate in, you can't afford to take a risk. And to be creative and to live off of ideas and to express yourself, you know, A, you got to be able to experiment. And B, you need time. And cities like New York are also moving so quickly. So I think that a lot of things have been turned on their head. And yet I think there's more creativity that's being produced than ever in the history of man. And it comes out in the form of, you know, my daughter making TikTok videos and, you know, foodies opening interesting restaurants and side snack businesses. There's a lot of creativity. It's just not coming out of the Paris runways and some of the traditional sources.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about when I was reflecting on this conversation, or reflecting on what I thought this conversation might become or be, I feel like during the 1980s, we began to see the power of celebrity and stardom really blow up. And I mean that the crossover celebrity, right? You had the athletes like the Michael Jordans, you had the Michael Jacksons, you had the Madonnas, you had people who were brands onto themselves. I don't know that that existed really before that. You might have had famous actors or musicians, but right. a person as a brand, I don't know if
I mean, you always had Marilyn Monroe and Elizabeth Taylor and so forth, but they weren't productized.
Right, exactly. Like Michael Jordan had the Air Jordans. And now it feels like we've gone to a new place where celebrity itself has become, in a sense, commoditized or democratized. Mm-hmm. And you've got all these, you know, quote, tastemakers or influencers, and they're driving so much of product placement and advertising and things like this. I mean, I've seen that in certain areas. How much of that is what's happening with fashion?
So I think that particular trend is short-lived because it's not credible. I mean, it's clear to anyone who is following an influencer when they are promoting something for pay, that it doesn't have the same quality as when they started out and developed their influence base and were just promoting something because they liked it. You know, you can see and feel the difference. And the bigger they get, I think the more obvious it is.
It feels less authentic.
It's a commercial.
Yeah, it
it's
doesn't
a commercial.
Feel authentic.
And then it's for the same reason that if I see a commercial on TV for Coca-Cola, I'm not more inclined to buy Coca-Cola because I saw the polar bear. You know, I am inclined if on a hot day, someone sitting next to me is sort of opening the can and I hear that pop and the bubbles come out and it just looks really refreshing. I mean, so our form of influence is changing. And I do think that there will always be some form of influence. Just that particular sort of Instagram type media for doing it is probably one that's going to run its course.
I like the way you describe the, was it a Pepsi or Coca-Cola?
Well, that was Coca-Cola.
But I like how you describe it. And that's, I got that feeling in the book, right? With how you wrote. You talked about it popping, the bubbles.
You know,
you're very attuned to the experience.
Well, so let's think of a champagne bottle. If you can send men to the moon, and occasionally a woman, you can come up with an easier way to open it than that freaking cork that pops people's eyeballs out every New Year's Eve. I mean, actually, I have a friend who's an eye doctor and says it's one of the biggest days of the year for, you know, calls to come because like people.
It does seem like a crazy time to be opening like shooting projectiles when everyone's drunk.
But it is part of the aesthetic experience of having champagne. It's a ritual. And I do think a champagne bottle, sort of like I don't like screw tops on wine bottles, even though there's nothing to indicate that the quality of wine is sacrificed. I feel like there's something in that ritual and there's something about the pop and there's something about the cork that is enjoyable.
So that word resonates. So does the word sacred. The word sacred came up to me when I was reading your book, but ritual, I think also, or maybe just now, there's a feeling of, for me, when I read your work or I read your thoughts, of the world and life being an experience. And that you want to get as much out of it, sensorially at least, as possible.
I do. And I would say as a marketer and a business person, the additional point is that people don't need more stuff. This is the first times in history where
We're drowning in crap.
And we're aware of the wastefulness. And we get pleasure more out of experiences. And, you know, it's why people are renting clothes because they can post it once. They don't even have to put it away in the closet. So my point being, we don't need stuff, right? There are a few things we need. You know, we need enough food to sustain ourselves, but we don't really even eat for that purpose. We eat for enjoyment. So it's incumbent upon makers of things to give something that provides more than utility. And what we do need, and it really is a human need, is to feel alive. And whatever you can do, whether you're offering a product or a service, to make that person on the other end feel alive, to feel human, whether it's through stimulating their senses, through giving them some joy, you know, through surprising them, through making them feel something that, you know, they didn't feel before they had interacted with your product, that is a service, and that will continue to be sold in the marketplace. The rest goes away.
So let's talk about the halo effect, because a few things came up. Again, what's the name of your Russian aesthetician
friend? Oh, Karita Friedman. She's going to love that you brought her up.
She's so funny. I know women like her. I love Russians.
And she's actually a great aesthetician as well.
You said she's excellent. In fact, I kept thinking that I need to get your recommendations. But there's something that she had said about, was it her husband? I think she mentioned her husband who's American and that, she's like, I can't do the accent, but why do you want to eat chicken? Why chicken nuggets makes you feel better? It's crap. It's bad or whatever. But that just made me think about how enduring these experiences are, right? The experience of going to McDonald's, so enduring, in fact, that grown adults who should know better than to eat that will eat it because it brings them back, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is a way of talking about this thing you talk about, which you call the halo effect, which is that when you're thinking about products or experiences, you're not just thinking about the actual experience itself, mm-hmm. but also you're thinking about the residue, the memory that it mm-hmm. will leave. And I'm familiar with some of this from the work of Daniel Kahneman. I think it's called the peak end rule, which is basically a heuristic that people remember the height of an experience and the way it ends. So talk to me a little bit about the significance of that in the work that you do.
Well, so the theory of halo is about 50%. Of course, it varies by different categories, but about 50% of people's pleasure with a particular product or service is some combination of their anticipation of experiencing it and their memory after the fact. And yet most companies deal with their customers just around that point of purchase and that point of usage. And so one of the best examples of a successful application of the halo effect, and I talk about it in the book, is Disney World. So when you actually think about Disney World, and most people have been there at one point or another, whether it was with your children or as a child, the actual experience is not that great. If you're in Orlando, particularly if you're there, you know, in hot summer months, it's a swamp. It's so hot. The lines are so long. It's expensive. There's so much noise. You know, kids screaming and crying and laughing. It can be annoying if too many people are laughing in your ears. It's an overload of experience. The food is not that great. But how many people, whatever the actual experience on that premise is, are dying to go back after the fact? And why? Some of it is just that for most people who go there, they were sitting on those plane tickets for maybe 2 months. And every day leading up to it, you know, whether it was the kids or other family members were sort of anticipating this delight. I can't wait to get to Disney. I can't wait to get to Disney. And then while they're at Disney, they're posting and they take great pictures and it's colorful. It's a very photogenic backdrop. And then, you know, afterwards, of course, you're not going to talk about the heat. Nobody ever talks about the swamp heat. But they talk a lot about, you know, oh, remember when we went on that ride? They don't talk about the line that they waited, the hour line getting on the ride. So I think they do a great job at leaving people with this combination of memories and anticipation so that they come back.
I think also the same, and you talked about this actually in the book, the same principle holds in biology with respect to labor and pregnancy and birth. And
giving
birth, right? I mean, I've had so many of my friends tell me that after they've given birth, the process itself is obviously horrifically painful or can be. And then right after they've given birth, they can't wait to do it again.
Yeah.
Which is just remarkable, right? And that speaks to it.
You know, I have a friend who had her first baby 2 months ago. The baby's so cute, but, you know, it wakes up every 2 hours and it's cranky and colicky. And, you know, you got to change the diaper and it's exhausting. And as I was observing her, it took me back to, you know, having raised two of my own and birthed two of my own. Like, that was not a pleasant time in my life. But I always describe my kids, and I genuinely believe they were like the best thing I ever did. Like, I never talk about the number of diapers I changed when I talk about my kids. So, you know, yeah, I guess nature has worked out the halo effect pretty well for the survival of the species.
It also, this thing also reminds me of when I used to get, actually, I didn't regularly go to this place. I probably went like once, maybe once. In fact, this is probably the peak end rule in full effect. I remember it once because it was such a great experience, but it was extremely expensive. And probably my barber was out of town or something. And I went to this Japanese hair salon. At the time, I was living on Cornelia Street years and years and years ago, and this would have been on West 4th between, I guess, 7th Avenue.
I think,
and
I remember this place. It was very glass, open front.
Well, and you'd go down. You'd walk down some stairs,
no,
I think.
No, I didn't go to that one.
Oh, yeah, I think that was the one. Maybe it was ground floor.
I'm not surprised it's Japanese. Did you refer to it as Japanese?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, they are by far the most aesthetic people.
Yeah, they are. And when I would leave, they would all the girls would stop. It was all girls that were in the store, and they'd be like, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And I'm like, okay, you're welcome, thank you.
They really appreciated you.
Exactly. And, you know, and that stays with you. So there's something else here I have also. You see this, you mentioned a designer. I thought his stuff was moderately ugly.
But, good, good. But, at least it wasn't forgettable.
Yeah, but no, it wasn't forgettable. This is forgettable. I mean, I just picked it because it was the ugliest thing I could find. I don't know if this qualifies as pretty ugly, which is the term.
Right,
that you
surely laid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a really interesting thing. And it kind of resonated because there are things, I mean, there are people, I don't find the East Village charming in any way or attractive, but some people really like it. They like the kind of gritty kind of feel. I feel like that kind of qualifies in a sense.
It does. I mean, the idea behind Je l'ai laid, which is the literal translation from French, is Je l'ai is pretty and laid is ugly. And it was historically used to describe a woman's face, and specifically a beautiful woman. And why was she beautiful? Because there was something a little off. She might have had a mole, maybe a gap between her teeth, something a little bit off, not so off that she really was ugly, but something that fell out of the standard of normal beauty. And I think what's important, and I use that to describe brands, that for things to stand out, they have to be a little off. When things are perfect, you know, too clean, too orderly, too predictable, they are forgettable. And I feel for a lot of businesses in this quest to be perfect and this lack of experimentation and this lack of whimsy that they lose sight of that. And it's why a few stores like Anthropologie, you know, which was designed to sort of replicate a walk in the forest. And it does a lot of things that are kind of illogical in the world of retail design. But it makes their store environments kind of exciting. The product's not exciting, but the store environments are.
That's so interesting, because I was going to ask you in terms of beauty marks and distinctions, because I don't think you mentioned in the book, but I guess this is what it covered. And you see here, I have a picture of Cindy Crawford, of course, the most beautiful woman with a mole on her face in the history of time, and Michael K. Williams, who has a giant scar from a knife that runs all the way down his head through the side of his face. And he, I remember distinctively an interview he did on television years ago where he talked about how he turned that into something that basically became a some kind of a distinction, something that beauty mark or whatever. And I think that's interesting too, because that makes me think of some work that I've read of philosophers in information science, which really looks at systems that are extremely simple, or let's say songs that are extremely simple. No one likes them. And if they're really chaotic, if it's all noise, it's grating, it's horrible. But like beauty is somewhere in between. It's in the complex. That's what's more human, right?
And I think, yes, because like, by the way, in nature, which is, you know, our most beautiful expression in this planet, you know, it doesn't look like a supermarket. It's not like all the trees are neatly lined up on the mountain. There is sort of a roughness and there's an organicness. And, you know, and the Japanese call it wabi-sabi, which is, you know, this idea that objects are living and that sometimes when, for example, a porcelain plate has a crack in it, that's all the more part of its glory.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And it's the problem I have, by the way, with a lot of modern architecture. When I walk the streets of New York, you know, all of these glass skyscrapers, I sort of say, just because they might be tilted a little bit differently at the top, there's nothing organic about them. There's nothing really interesting about a lot of these buildings.
I think that's an interesting observation. I also wonder what you can tell about individuals based on where they choose to live in Manhattan. Because I think also sometimes you go through phases and you like to move to different neighborhoods. Have you seen Man in the High Castle?
This is the one that if the Germans had won?
Yeah.
I saw the first several episodes.
Because I'd be fascinated.
Dark.
Yeah, very dark. But I think that's an interesting example. One, the point about the Japanese and the sort of the spirit or the essence of the teacup, the broken teacup. But really the Nazis, their whole world was, it had to be perfect. It needed to be cleansed and everything. And whereas the Japanese in that movie, there was just much more soul and place for humanity. Pauline, I'm going to move us to the overtime.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much for being on the program and sticking around. For regular listeners, you know the drill. If you're new to the program or if you haven't subscribed to our Patreon overtime, autodidact or super nerd tiers, you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/hiddenforces or looking right into the description of this podcast where I have a link and you can gain access to the overtime that I'm about to have with Pauline, as well as a transcript, as well as the rundown, which is full of pictures of Kanye West, of Spock in drag,
and drag. That's funny.
And pictures of Pauline as well, looking fabulous.
Wow, and my Faroe Island skirt, my cloud skirt.
This is my favorite picture of
you. Oh, thank you. Wow, that skirt was made by two designer friends. And it's a whole show unto itself about the Faroes.
It feels very Alice in Wonderland-esque.
Hopefully I won't, you know, fall into that trap. So that's a nightmare.
Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you. It's been a delight talking to you.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Creative Media Design Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.